welcoming into the program from defector.com. He is quite simply America's greatest writer and maybe handsomest man alive as well. David Roth joins us.
Thanks very much, Rich. I was worried you were going to leave out how good looking I am. So, yeah, that checks out to me. I appreciate it.
I just read the script you sent.
Yeah, thanks, man.
That's what we do.
It's the first time I've been introduced as from Defector, though, so that was kind of cool.
Well, yes, and it's real and it's spectacular. I love it so far.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it's I'm sure there's probably still some people out there that don't know about our website.
What?
Yeah, I know, it's weird. It's weird to think about, but it's a big country. But yeah, everybody that quit Deadspin last year, we started a new website, or almost all of us, and people have subscribed. We're having fun with it. And yeah, there's sports to write about, so that part of it is also kind of nice.
It's great, and love the Distraction podcast that you and Drew do as well.
Thank you. Yeah, that's been fun. I mean, we recorded, so I was in Maine for 3 weeks, the longest we've ever been up there, and I recorded the last 3 episodes from there, and it was... like every one of those things is just kind of like a wireless adventure. I recorded it one time in a motel, like with trucks going by on Route 1, like, I don't know, 50 feet away. They still made it sound good, which is why it's cool to work with professionals. So shout out to Stitcher for removing the truck noise from my half of the audio.
Well, in your first full piece for Defector, a wonderful analysis of Skip Bayless, who apparently people actually listened to here in 2020, and it's what's depressing that actually is a thing still.
He is kind of a depressing guy just in general. I mean, like, he's made a good life for himself. Like, I'm sure that if we could trade apartments, like, I would reconsider some of the regard in which I hold him. But yeah, man, wow. So this was like last week. He gave some sort of, this is like what his job is to go on TV every day for 4 hours and like act upset about whatever is happening. And it's always something that like no one will remember 3 hours later, you know, that like today he probably cried because Cam Newton wore like a yellow suit to the Patriots first game or something like that. And that just sends the wrong message and like disrespectful to Dick Tracy or whatever it is that is on his mind at that time. And then he moves on. In this case, it was he was disapproving of Dak Prescott talking about experiencing anxiety and depression during the, you know, the worst days of the pandemic and after his brother's suicide. And it was so callous and so strange that you just don't write about Skip Bayless. You don't make eye contact. You keep it moving. You treat him the way that you would treat somebody on the bus, like eating tuna out of a can with his hands, you know? And in this case, I made the mistake of making eye contact with the guy eating tuna with his hands. And I got a blog out of it.
Yeah, he's like, I don't know. He's like a guy who works for Barstool with better hair and a slightly improved command of the language.
It is. It's weird because I think that there's a lack of joy to his approach to it that, like, you don't want to give Barstool too much credit, but I think that as a general rule, some people there are having fun. Skip Bayless always acts like he just got really terrible health news, like about a pet. And yet he's always doing that in the context of, you know, like, is somebody disrespecting Tim Tebow's legacy somewhere? Like, are the NFL schedules out and were they unfair to the AFC South? Like, the ability to just remain unhappy about every insignificant sports thing that happens, it's a sort of a talent, and he's made a life behind it. But, man, I am glad that I do not share that.
Yeah, and I like you. I'm happy to have sports back, the good, the bad, and the ugly of it. And we get to see the ugly here with the way the Red Sox season has gone. And you get some of that as a Mets fan as well.
Some of it, yeah. I was thinking today, we were talking at work, the season is almost over. There's 2 weeks left in it. And I feel like I never really, started watching the Mets. I mean, I did. I've definitely seen enough horrific blundering. Like, I know that a real Mets season happened. Like, I watched Edwin Diaz give up a home run that decapitated a cardboard cutout someplace. You know, like, it's all the stuff that I sort of, you know, accounting for pandemic nonsense. Like, it's all real. And yet, like, somehow it never really hit. I mean, the Red Sox season, I think, is especially depressing because it's you know, they're in the way that every team is kind of like playing through these weird circumstances under, you know, this sort of collapsed schedule, the Sox like doubly didn't try. And that attempt to sort of spin this season as an attempted reset, I think, is like kind of insulting to fans. Like, at least when the Mets, like, they insult fans every year, but it's always in exactly the same way. This is a new one, I think, for Sox fans who had gotten used to being treated a little bit better.
And even beyond the Red Sox, I just feel so disconnected from it. I read about Albert Pujols tying Willie Mays with his 660th home run, and my first thought was, they don't count exhibition games. Oh, wait, no, this is real.
I know, it's so bizarre. Like, all of it has been... Even the parts of it that are cool, you know, that, like, I'm trying to think of, like, the things that I've seen this year that I liked. Fernando Tatis Jr. has been great. That rando quad A guy throwing a no-hitter for the Cubs.
Yeah.
Where there were only 5 swings and misses in the whole game. That's a fluke, but, like, that's part of what I like about baseball. It's not easy to keep going. And I'll thank you not to make me keep doing it, because it is... Like, I mean, Pujols, the Angels in general are one of the more depressing organizations that you could imagine. But, like, yeah, none of it quite feels right. I'm sure that when we get down to the postseason and the good teams are left and, you know, it's an opportunity to watch the Dodgers be great or, you know, see whatever team comes out of the American League, that, like, I'll be around then. You know, like, I snapped right back in with the NBA, even though it's similarly abstracted and kind of weird. But, yeah, I think the one thing that I keep coming back to about this year that is so difficult is the feeling of just lost time, you know, of just kind of suspension where nothing really moved. And, you know, a lost baseball season is a sad thing. Like, even it's not the saddest thing going right now by a long shot. But, yeah, as they say, it's not what you want.
David Roth with us here on Dante. Well, as much as I've been... dispassionate, completely unconcerned about MLB. I love the NBA playoffs. Part of it is because I find this Celtics team a lot of fun to watch and likable. I enjoy cheering for them. But even teams that I have no rooting interest in, I've enjoyed watching the games. And for some reason, I find that bizarre bubble entertaining.
Yeah, I think that it's been really good. The parts of it that have been strange, you know, like the Zoom fans and all of that, I found, and the crowd noise and all the other sort of artificial stuff, I've found pretty easy to tune out. And the basketball itself has been wonderful, you know, and the Celtics, this is where I'm lucky that I don't have, like, Knicks fan disease, because I know a lot of my friends who are Knicks fans, like, on principle, know that they should like the Celtics team, and yet are just categorically incapable of enjoying watching the Celtics play basketball. And when the Nets left New Jersey and I decided to sort of take a more of an agnostic rooting position with the NBA, I guess I didn't realize just how thoroughly liberated I am, because, like, I kind of think the Celtics are cool, and that's not something I really talk about much out loud with my friends down here, because people tend to get real upset when you say it. But I love Smart. I mean, I love watching Jason Tatum. Like, whatever weird thing was going on with his head last year where he was trying to play like Kobe, that's gone. They are fun to watch.
Steve Nash, the right man for the job. Is that going to be a good fit, do you think?
That's weird. You know, I thought the coach that the Nets got rid of, Kenny Atkinson, was brilliant and did a great job with that team. But I think that's sort of, I mean, the story, I guess, with Nash is that's Kevin Durant's guy and this is Kevin Durant's team. I'm not sure how well it's going to work with Kyrie Irving, but I mean, you're familiar with this. It's unclear how well anything works with Kyrie Irving. That's kind of his charm. There's something weird about the idea of, like, bringing in a kind of like a first-time figurehead coach to run a team like the Nets. Because what Atkinson got out of the team before the superstars were sort of bolted onto the roster, I mean, they really played great. They played very deep and very hard and very well on defense. And it's going to be the idea that, like, that carefully constructed roster with all of these people that know their roles next year is going to be, you know, a brilliant basketball mind, but a first time coach and all of those guys standing in the corners while KD isolates at the top of the key seems like kind of a waste, you know?
All right. Away from the world of sports, And I don't want any spoilers here, but if you can tell us maybe one thing that drew you to the wonder that is The Road to Christmas.
Well, the most recent, so this I should explain. So that is a Hallmark movie. I do a podcast where I watch Hallmark movies and talk about them with the writer Jeb Lund. And that one was dumb luck. It was the process of selecting Hallmark movies to watch is basically me looking at the listings and setting a DVR and going through descriptions. You know, you want to, there is some process. I think I've seen enough Candace Cameron movies at this point to know that is not a good choice for me.
Are you more a fan of the Kelly Martin oeuvre?
Yes, I would say that, yeah. I mean, I think there's a different energy there. But there's like, of the Hallmark, I don't want to totally derail the broadcast here and give you my pantheon of Hallmark leading ladies.
I'd
be happy to do that.
I would kill for that, I'll be honest.
So you got Candace Cameron is like, you know, one of your bigger stars. Lori Loughlin was before she ran afoul of the law. You see a lot of Lacey Chabert there.
And yes.
As great as she was in Mean Girls, she's not a great Hallmark lead either. The ones that you really have to sort of flag as high opportunity watches, Alicia Witt, always delightful. And then the woman that is the lead in Roads to Christmas is named Jessie Schramm. For some reason, I know all of these people now, like people who otherwise like mostly just appear in other Hallmark movies or had like a, you know, an 8-episode arc on Nashville as a troubled country starlet. Now I'm like, oh, it's Jessie Schramm, but she's good. Yeah, she's great. You know, you got to give her a chance to sing, right? Like, but that's like one other person I could talk to about this. And like, well, my wife and Jeb Hunt, and that's it. But Road to Christmas, we liked it, I think, mostly because this is what happens when a Hallmark movie is good, is that like you briefly forget that it is a Hallmark movie. Like, it's, at some point, it obviously, you know, you're reminded of it because all anybody does is talk about Christmas. But otherwise, it was, you know, elegantly plotted and written and, you know, likable performances by the leads. I'm sorry I'm talking about this.
No, I asked you. I want to know. This is important information.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. We've done so many episodes of that podcast at this point that we've pretty well like Stockholm syndromed ourselves into grading these. We're a really remarkable curve. Like showing Road to Christmas to a normal person whose brain had not been damaged by having watched like 90 Hallmark movies very closely while taking notes, they might have a different response to it than I did. But for me, it was like, I don't know, I'm like one of those monkeys in an experiment. Like I pushed a button and a little treat came out and I'm like, this is one of the best treats I've ever had.
All right. I always like to ask you about members of the Trump administration, because it's such an entertaining and interesting group of talent that he's acquired here in his version of the best and the brightest. So this month, yeah, I would like to focus on your thoughts on Postmaster General Louis DeJoy.
Oh, I love him. I think he's really excellent. There's different types of Trump administration guys. There's some of them, you know, that you like Wilbur Ross, for instance, is not a person that I would ever meet anybody that would look like that. The closest I would come is if you remember Jeff Dunham had like a grouchy old man puppet. That is actually Wilbur Ross. But the other members of it, of the administration, every now and then you'll get a guy that's like a sort of a tri-state area type. That growing, you know, the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut metro area where I grew up, Louis DeJoy has that vibe. And the stuff that I've seeing him testifying before Congress and being both like really aggressive but also really confused and ill-informed, that definitely struck a chord for me. Like I had a lot of guys like that yelling at me during youth basketball games when I was a kid. You know, so it was kind of a nice reminder. And then I think there was a great story about him donating like $2.5 million to Duke so his kid could be on the tennis team, even though his kid wasn't a competitive tennis player. And that is my type of guy. That to me is like absolutely the, you know, S-class Trump admin types.
Wilbur Ross
have so much money, and like that's all they want to spend it on is like boots and getting their kid a fake tennis credential.
Wilbur Ross reminds me, and I'll date myself greatly here, but he reminds me of, I think he was the agriculture secretary, and I don't even remember who the president was, but Earl Butz, who famously put his boot in his mouth many, many a time.
That was a Nixon appointee, right?
I think so, yeah.
He was legendary because it's like almost all of the really good quotes about like the Southern strategy or any of the sort of reactionary, movement things that were pioneered during the Nixon administration. There's like, you know, maybe you get some like euphemism stuff from other candidates. And then like Earl Butz himself is just like, my big thing's saying racial slurs. And we learned that worked. Which is like a guy that would just come out and absolutely read the stage directions instead of the dialogue, which is always very helpful if you're trying to study history and don't have a long attention span.
I don't want to make you go down. Yes, he was both in the, Kerry says he was both in the Nixon and Ford administrations. Well nice. Done there. And I don't want you to have to go down the rabbit hole too much with Trump, but just a basic thing. I mean, it's been a rough couple of weeks of revelations, whether it's Bob Woodward's book or Cohen's book or just his own comments. But why have we reached the point where clearly there's nothing? There is nothing that he could do or say that will stick in the eyes of that 25-30% or whatever they are.
I think that at some point we have to sort of address the idea that maybe they like that it's bad. Not that, there are people obviously that operate, in a different media sort of universe and that believe things about Trump that are not true. You know, there's people that think that he fixed healthcare, that he built the wall, whatever. And those people, are not being well informed, but it's not, at some point, if you believe that stuff, then it might be that you will never stop believing it. The thing that kind of fascinates me is the way in which he doesn't try and in which he fails, like the unwillingness to like even really have a coordinated national response to the pandemic, for instance, that like a lot of that is just Trump being Trump, that like the guy doesn't have an attention span. He doesn't really care very much about other people and he doesn't like doing things that are hard. And that's fine. I mean, at the very least I can relate on the last part, but I think that like, it's that performance of not caring, like, and being so outward about it and just kind of being like, oh God, why is everybody yelling at me about this? 200,000 people, what, did you know them? You know, like that sort of like the brash, like sort of nasty aggressiveness of it. I think that there's a lot of people that, first of all, maybe are like that themselves, but that also like really do read that as, not admirable, but frank.
Yeah, and I think there are people who wish they could be like that.
Yes. See, that's exactly right. I think that there's something about him that's like an aspirational figure, but not to anybody that you'd ever want to meet.
Yeah,
that there is like an element of like, because he's untouchable, because he does what he wants and says what he wants, that like, as long as you don't care about what the consequences of that are, and if it's only about the doing and the saying, then like, yeah, I guess he's somebody to admire. It's just like, there's obviously something that happens after you do something and say something, and that's when it gets complicated.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that part myself, but we'll see.
Yeah, good Lord.
David Roth, check out The Defector. It is great. You're going to love the work that David and a talented group of writers put together for you. We appreciate it as always, my friend. Thanks so much for being with us.
Man, thank you. Have a good one. I'll talk to you later.
You got it. David Roth here in Downtown.